Ho, ho, ho. Here's another podcast package from your Mincing Rascals with a song of good cheer at the very end. Listen all the way through to that. I'm John Williams. This week, why were pot expungements a popular and controversial topic this week? The Rascals start there. The tragedy of singer Juice WRLD, a fair tax for fat cats and merit pay for cops. And then we go to Trump land. That's impeachment world. Oh, the Mincing Rascals have a lot to mince on this week. Today is Thursday. Happy December 12th, 2019. It's 12:42 in the afternoon. Hi, I'm John Williams. This is the Mincing Rascals, our little weekly podcast we record at the studios of WGN Radio. Listen for me on WGN Radio weekdays from, 9 a.m. to noon.
I'm Steve Bertrand. I am news anchor for John Williams and others.
Lisa Donovan with the Chicago Tribune. I write the Spin Politics newsletter out every afternoon.
And I'm Eric Zorn, the cheerful columnist from the Tribune.
Cheerful? Why are you cheerful, Eric?
Because Mary Schmeek and I are in the middle of our Songs of Good Cheer.
That's right. Have you done your first show yet?
Our first show on Wednesday night.
Oh, that's right. That was last night.
Went extremely well. And you're coming Friday.
We're going to be there Friday. I was talking to Mary about it the other day. I said, can you still get tickets? She goes, oh, no, you can't get tickets. Yeah. It is sold out, but she said day of sales sometimes happens.
Sometimes, yeah.
So Songs of Good Cheer is the annual Christmas sing you do with the folks from the Old Town School of Folk Music with your fellow columnist Mary Schmeek. The two of you are great reporters and writers. Who knew you were good singers and instrumentalists, too?
It was a well-kept secret. Still is, kind of, after 21 years.
They sell out the Old Town School doing half a dozen shows, right?
We're doing six this year, yes. Yeah. That's right. We started with just two, and now it's six. So.
Have you guys been to their show?
I have, yeah.
Have you been to it?
I have never been to it.
You've got to do this thing,
no,
Steve. It would really put a sense of the holiday in you, especially.
I could use it.
Because you could use that
a little bit.
Okay, guys, let's just talk about a couple of the stories in the news. I want to talk about President Trump's week because it should be discussed if the president is getting impeached, and he is. But we'll put that, as we have of late, on the back half of our podcast this week. And we'll start with Kim Fox, the Cook County State's Attorney, who was at a press conference with the governor this week, and she said that prosecutors must own up to their role in the harm that they've done by prosecuting people for crimes involving marijuana over the years.
As a prosecutor who's previously prosecuted these cases, we must own our role in the harm that we have caused, and particularly to communities of color.
I think Kim Fox has a way of saying the right things the wrong way. I must tell you, our phone lines lit up. The text lines did, too. I baited them a little bit because I took exception to the way she
put it. You did bait them.
Marijuana convictions? Yeah, that was dumb. Racially disproportionate? Right. Should we expunge these records? Yeah. Do prosecutors need to own the harm that they did? Because those were her words.
Well, if you are Kim Fox, yes, you have to get in front of this because she's up for election. She's a Democrat up for election in March, and that decides the state's attorney's race. She's got to get in front of it because her competitors are going to come after her and say, oh, well, you're talking about expungement when you were a prosecutor. And she said that. She said, I own my own role.
I did these cases, right.
Yeah, own my own role in this. And so I think she's just trying to get in front of some political pushback.
Do line prosecutors really have the authority? Would people who are working for Anita Alvarez or for Dick Devine, did they have the authority to say, well, I'm not going to prosecute these cases. By God, I'll sit here in my office until you fire me, but I'm not going to prosecute these marijuana cases. I mean, you could perhaps lay some of this at the feet of the state's attorneys, previous state's attorneys, but even then they're governed by state law, city law. They're tasked with enforcing the law. I think we would have had a lot of consternation if, say, Dick Devine or Anita Alvarez had just said, you know what, I know this is the law, but I'm not going to enforce
it. Well, right, okay, so there's a couple ways of looking at it. One is that if, well, don't hand it down to Bart because Bart won't do this when he doesn't do these. We get that. But there's also prosecutorial discretion, and, you know, there are times when you can pull a charge back or slap a charge on. You know, they do have discretion that way, and I'm sure there was
happens all the time.
And we all own this a little bit. I mean, cheering on the war on drugs or whatever. I mean, it didn't work. It was a mistake. You know, people suffered for it, and so if she's going to say we need to own this a little bit, I think if someone else had said it and not the Jussie Smollett, Kim Fox, I don't think it would be an issue.
You agree with that?
I think that that's true. And I also think that this disproportionately affected, the war on drugs disproportionately affected African Americans, Latinos. she, as an African-American woman, she has to get in front of this. Again, this is going to be an ugly campaign up until March, and she's got to make sure that she's playing a little bit of offense as defense.
Are we sure that her opponents are going to attack her from that flank?
She's got a deep-pocketed opponent in Bill Conway, and that you have to be prepared for anything and everything.
The criticism of her handling of this? I mean, she's saying she's going to do it. Is it that they're going to say, no, you should not expunge these cases?
Are they going to say, if I'd been in charge, this would have been done years ago? I'm not sure that's true. I mean, someone like Conway is a fairly conservative Democrat, right?
I'm saying that if she was part of if they try to sort of start looking into her prosecutorial history here and find out that, okay,
she was putting people away.
Yeah, I think that there could be some pushback.
Well, I guess it depends on who the voter is, because there's plenty of people that would say, yeah, if you're black or white, if you went to jail for a pot conviction, that's on you. Now, you could also say, well, why don't you prosecute more white kids as much as you're doing the black kids? That's a true conversation and statement.
But you're not taking into account the fact that where the copper might have looked the other way if it was a white kid, or he didn't if it was a black kid.
John, let me put it this way. I mean, there used to be laws against homosexual contact, gay sex, for instance, and people went to jail for that. I remember they would do arrests and so on. I mean, and you can't say, looking back, well, that's on you if you were gay. You know, you made the choice to break the law. I mean, I think there is a way of saying in this situation, these laws were draconian. They were unfair. They were unfairly applied, but not to like too much point the finger at any one group of people and say, let's move forward. Let's erase what we now can acknowledge were the overreaches of the past. Let's move forward and try to get rid of those without necessarily like pointing the finger at either side.
Right.
You know? I mean, I don't know.
I don't like the points I'm making here, but I'm telling you that these are out there. And the refutation.
I'll tell you what, the goose doesn't stand alone on this one.
Well, I'll just tell you what I've been hearing, and that is those people weren't being arrested because they were black. They were being arrested because they were doing something illegal relative to marijuana. That's why they got arrested.
Right. And I think we can say, looking back, that those laws were too draconian. That it was that we now realize that this thing should have been decriminalized or even made legal. And we acknowledge that, but we don't have to, like, flagellate certainly
let's move on.
I mean, we can say, well, I mean, we acknowledge the mistakes of the past, but let's not wallow in them. And again, I'm thinking of the line prosecutors and so on who enforce these laws, and I'm thinking, do they deserve to be singled out for scorn here?
The only other thing, though, John, and you just glossed over this, is the fact that I think the numbers show that white kids smoke pot just as much as black kids.
So I understand.
Right.
And they're not prosecuted at nearly the rate.
That's true, too.
Okay, so there is that.
Yeah, I'm not talking about that.
But you are saying if you did the crime, you need to own it. There's a lot of people who apparently were doing the crime who weren't forced to own it.
Maybe my callers would feel differently if all of their kids had been getting arrested all of these years, too.
Right, if they were pulled over for having a broken taillight, which was a lot of this stuff. Like, oh, you have a broken taillight, we'll pull them over and see what they've got. You know, and they're kids. Or they're walking up to them on the street. You know, the same percentage of white kids smoke weed as African-American kids, as Latino kids. It's across the board. But when you're talking about unfair enforcement and sort of flooding these neighborhoods and enforcing the laws there and not, say, sort of on, you know, the north side of the city or in pockets of the north side of the city,
it's not fair.
And I'll stipulate to your suggestion that Kim Fox has a way of saying the right thing in the wrong way, but I do think that this is a politically smart move on her part, and that this will play well with a lot of constituencies, and having the governor by her side.
Oh,
and
maybe
absolutely.
Maybe she said the wrong thing the right way. All I'm telling you is I'm talking to one radio audience. It's not everybody. Lord, it's not everybody.
But when I was watching some of the Twitter activity last night, and boy, there's still a lot of the Jussie Smollett hangover is just ever present. Eric, did you just say, so you said that a little bit ago, I think that that's what we're talking about. Anything she says now, yes, people are going to come back with that. They're ticked off about that.
I've said this many times, but she has got to figure out a way to explain the whole Jussie Smollett story if she's going to succeed in March. She hasn't.
Maybe she needs a new TV ad, because the first one only addressed the topic without doing what you just said.
It's as baffling to me as Joe Biden's failure to have a crisp, solid explanation for what happened with Hunter Biden in Ukraine. I don't think it's that important a story, but the Republicans are going to make
Joe
it
needs
really
a,
important.
Joe needs a better better answer.
He needs a better answer than, hey, buddy, let's have a push-up contest.
Give me.
Yeah, right.
If you want to check my shape on, let's do push-ups together, man. Let's run. Let's do whatever you want to do. Let's take it on the feet.
All right, but give me your answer to that. Like, what you be Joe Biden for a second. What would satisfy people?
I think you would have to expect. I would say this was a bad move on his part to do this. That the optics of it were really bad. I should have counseled him against it. I didn't. That I own that failure. But there is no evidence that Burisma, the oil company, or that Ukraine in general got any advantage whatsoever from the Obama administration.
No.
I was just the vice president. I had no power.
You know, and I think all of that's true. He hasn't literally said that, though, huh?
He hasn't admitted that it was, the thing is, like, it was bad. I mean, they hired, I mean, we're way off topic here, but they hired Hunter Biden.
The vice president's son.
Because they thought they were going to get some influence with the U.S. government. I mean, how can you possibly deny that?
Of course they did.
But this happens all the time, right? Famous people get their kids hired.
Political family whose kids have been hired because their dad or mom was famous.
The set is so large it doesn't contain single elements, John. But I think you have to acknowledge that. And also let's acknowledge that Heather Sharon has walked
into the studio. Heather Sharon has just plowed into the studios. Hi, Heather. How are you?
I'm all right.
You were busy doing journalism or something?
I was.
Well, that will not do.
Well, I'll just catch you up. I've been talking about Kim Fox with the gang, and they've all agreed with my positions on her statements about expungement. So without dwelling on that, is...
No one believes that's true, by the way.
More fake news there.
What's your wisdom? You're out of breath.
I'm a little out of breath because I was so upset about being late for this. It was just the highlight of my week.
Oh, well, I'm sorry to hear that. Okay, so give me your wisdom.
I think it's an interesting take because it doesn't include the fact that this was the law. And prosecutors have limited ability to sort of deviate from that, not to mention that it was the judges, too, that ultimately handed down the statements. I watched what she said after that event, and I was surprised that she seemed to claim so much power for prosecution, for prosecutors, especially when I've been covering the debate over the gun laws and whether there should be bond reform, where she's basically saying this is on us and this is something that we can only do to a limited extent because so much of it depends on the chief judge's offices. So perhaps there's an argument to be made that she's trying to have it both ways.
Yeah, well, maybe that's where we were before you walked in.
This is a great, it's like putting her in a soundproof booth and coming in and we discuss it for 15 minutes.
Like Tattletales with Bert Convy back in the 70s.
But there is a little confirmation bias here because I think she said what I thought and you guys are probably thinking, she affirmed what we said.
She made exactly my point, but she improved on it. So I just wanted to.
And she did it while panting. So yeah.
A ladylike pant, I would like to note. What was interesting was I thought that she refused to answer a question about her campaign afterwards.
Yes.
And then said, this isn't a political event, so I'm not going to talk about that.
Oh, really?
And then she turned around and used the footage from the event in a campaign spot.
It was on Twitter, it was in an email. I got an email about it.
Right.
And so she wouldn't answer any campaign questions, but yeah, use that. And obviously, you knew that was coming, that walk down the hall with J.B. Pritzker.
I want to change topics now. Thank you for your thoughts on that. Juice WRLD has died. Last week, that sentence would have made no sense to me. Today, I understand that there was a just-turned 21-year-old, what's the music genre? Emo, hip-hop, rap? I'm not exactly sure what you call that music. But I've listened to plenty of it because my sons have been fans.
I have these lucid dreams where I can't move a thing, thinking of you in my bed.
He was a Homewood Flossmoor graduate a couple of years ago. He struck it big. Jared Higgins, Juice WRLD's Lucid Dreams was a monstrous hit. His album had gone multi-platinum. He'd signed a multi-million dollar record deal. Tribune rock critic Greg Kot told us about his music and his rise up, but it all came crashing down when the private jet he was on landed at Midway Airport. Authorities were waiting for the plane. They found drugs, guns, armor-piercing bullets on board. There was a scene where Higgins had a quote-unquote a medical emergency. He was given Narcan. He later died. Today, his mother told TMZ he had a prescription drug dependency. He sings about that in a lot of his songs, and she hopes others will learn from his fate. Texters to my show were less sympathetic. And I'm sorry that his legacy for those people who only knew him for this story will find that it reinforces their narrow view of young black men or young black men in entertainment or something. I mean, it's just this cliched, tragic ending.
I just feel like, too, he not only was singing about it, he was on social media about it. And it goes to the core of for any of us who have a loved one who has a dependency problem. Just sort of like, how come we can't help them? How come we're not in a place as a society? I mean, I have a sibling who has a pretty serious dependency issue, and you know, we're all sort of we're a big family. We're all waiting for that day where we get the phone call, and it's just, how could we be that? You know, how could we be both sort of like, we want to help him, we've tried to talk to him, and then yet there's really not a lot anybody can do for them. He's been in the hospital, and they're like, well, there's nothing we can do for him.
Yeah.
There's no, we don't accept that this is an issue, this is a public health issue, and that really, you know, hospitals, society, we need to help people who are in the situation, not let them talk about
it. Was this a dependency issue, though, or was this a wider conspiracy or drug issue? I mean, if they had, I mean, I'd heard one.
You mean because of the volume of drugs on the plane?
Was there 70 pounds of marijuana?
Yeah,
and some Percocet and some codeine.
Yeah, I mean, when you're talking about that volume, if he had had, say, a couple of containers of prescription medication, right, that he shouldn't have had, or even drugs he shouldn't have, that's a big difference from the cache of drugs and guns that were on that plane. So I'm not sure that these conversations are not just taking place on completely parallel tracks. That, yeah, $3 million, is that the deal that he got? I mean,
yeah,
it's not going to buy your way out of drug dependency.
It's also not going to get you, there were, what, a dozen people on that plane, so I don't think it was just, my understanding is there's a question about whether it was this is entourage or whether this
sure.
is a group of people
right.
who kind of pooled their money
right.
and were going to Chicago. And so I don't know. But I don't know that we have enough information, but I just sort of feel like him talking about his singing about, talking about his drug problems and sharing that, and there was seemingly no way to intervene. It sent me into sort of this helpless sort of spiral, really.
He was so young. And he was also from Homewood, Flossmoor, which wasn't sufficiently street for some people to warrant the sort of lifestyle that maybe this cache of drugs and guns was evidence of. I was sorry to see it devolve into that. Literally, when I did the segment on the radio, I thought, I'm going to introduce you to this music you don't know and the tragedy of this young man. And people were like, nah, I'm not having that.
You know, he grew up in Calumet Park, and the two times I was there to cover a story, I was a police reporter, and we got stopped by the police. What are you doing here? I can remember the Sun-Times photographer and I, when I was there at the time, like, what do you mean? Well, what's your business here?
Or they weren't trying
to
protect you.
No.
They thought you were there to buy some drugs.
Yeah. And so I started reading about it. And there is a serious issue with guns and drugs there. And, you know, he at one point lived there, so I don't know what he saw. But I think when you have somebody police pulling you over, asking what your business is there, because they don't recognize you. It's a small town. I have no idea if race was an issue. You know, because we were there, but
in your case, yeah.
Yeah.
Can we separate the issue of his tragic death with the idea, like, let's say, to play this out, if he had just simply been arrested at the airport with this stuff, and we had, I mean, or if he had had this seizure at home or something without this other, I mean, these two stories are very hard to put together into some sort of coherent narrative and draw a moral lesson from them. I mean, if he'd just been arrested and he was this promising young artist and he's got the world on a string seemingly, and he's been arrested with all these guns and drugs, and you know, and that's one story. And then the second story is this tragic death, and we try to put them together into some sort of coherent thought. It's very difficult.
Or the one cancels the other out.
That's
conceivably
possible.
As
because
both.
It's not unusual for suspects with drugs on them to ingest them and overdose. This is we've seen that a lot over the years,
so intentionally or otherwise.
Otherwise.
Well, you're
yes.
describing unintentional.
Yeah, perhaps. I mean, that's a good point. We don't know if people were like, okay, I'm not going to go to jail for this. This is my way out. I don't know.
Don't you flush the drugs down the toilet or something?
I know, yeah, I mean, really.
Not if you're on a plane. Yeah.
This was the worst of all options.
Yeah, so I have a 10-year-old, and she really liked his music. So this was sort of the first prominent death of a famous person that I had to sort of help her contextualize. And so when she heard about it, we didn't know about, you know, what had happened at Midway. So I said, well, we've talked before about how a lot of his music talks about drugs. And, you know, so what do you think about that? That's my go-to parenting cop-out. What do you think about that? And she's just like, well, you know, that's not good, but I didn't think that it would mean he would die. And I said, well, that's part of what's dangerous about drugs, that you don't always know what's going to happen if you take them. So it was sort of probably a growing up moment for her, but also a growing up moment for me, where I sort of felt that pressure of, I need to explain what happened here in a coherent way. And much like Eric, I don't know that I could really. Right.
A lot of us were just angry, too. I think that's a fair emotion as well. I mean, I think that's maybe what I've been expressing, is just exasperation or anger. Kind of the way I felt when Kurt Cobain died, or when Amy Winehouse died, or people like that. And I just think, oh, I'm just angry about this whole set of circumstances without assigning blood.
Or Janis Joplin, or Jimi Hendrix back.
The list goes on.
Well, of course, he has that famous line in his song that he's not going to make it to the 27 Club. He's not going to make it past 21. And of course, he did not make it much past his 21st birthday.
Yeah. Different topic now. J.B. Pritzker just dumped, what, $5 million into his campaign to pass a graduated income tax referendum?
Well, he just dumped $5 million into this campaign to promote and to explain to the public, campaign to the public, why the graduated income tax is a good idea, why people should vote in favor of it. If you are kind of low, under what, $150,000 annual earner, or your household is, you will be paying less. If it's over $150,000 a year, you will be paying more. And I think there have been some questions about how ethical that is. Okay, you know, he's able to sort of push his agenda, which helps him politically. So he's able to push his government agenda because he's got this vast wealth. And it's for political gain, so, right? All of this stuff goes into sort of the next round of campaigning for office, and this is a cornerstone of his both campaign and his administration.
So he has undue political clout or weight because of his personal wealth.
Bruce Rauner basically funded the Republican Party when he was in office.
It's the same thing.
That's what I'm saying. So Pritzker would give money to candidates. Isn't it the same thing?
But I think it's hilarious that we all sort of collectively said, oh, $5 million, that's right. Not a lot. You know,
and in radio people,
in the context of what he spent to get to be governor,
oh, yeah,
it's not that much, which is crazy. And it's sort of how, you know, things have sort of spun on that axis, because not only, you know, are we used to what Rauner did, we saw what Pritzker did, but it does raise an ethical issue, because it doesn't make sense for the sitting governor to be campaigning for a ballot issue. I think that's an open question.
Why is that?
Why?
Well, because, you know, he's going to benefit from it politically, but he's also using his position as governor to say, hey, this is the right thing to do.
Then it contrasts that with an attorney general's candidate. I mean, he would certainly campaign for an attorney general's candidate, so why not a ballot initiative?
Well, what's a governor to do? If you're a governor and you have views on all of these issues, taxes, politics, education,
and $5 million.
You advocate for them. $5 million is nothing to him. I guess to me what it does is it begs the question, does $5 million of advertising, say, unduly influence the state of Illinois in a way that the governor gets what he wants?
Well, I think it's a larger part of a larger picture, because we saw a report from the government's finance forecasting group that basically said, we need this graduated income tax, because if we don't get it, here's how far we're going to be in the hole. And Pritzker sort of took that official government report and said, see, here's proof. And he faced pushback for sort of using the levers of government to push this ballot initiative. So when you're governor and you're doing stuff like that, and you put $5 million of your own money toward it, that line gets a little blurry.
Yeah, and just because Rauner self-funded and put millions into his own campaign doesn't make me feel at ease. I feel like we're going back to sort of this, what, the industrial age.
The Gilded Age.
We are going to see, though, a major campaign against this referendum from right-wing groups and conservative groups. And I wish Austin
groups
were here, because Austin's, the Illinois Policy Institute, is foursquare against this. I'm in favor of it.
For graduated income tax in the state of Illinois?
Yeah, we have it in the federal government. And the idea is that the more money you make, you pay a greater percentage, because that reduces the pain on lower income earners. If we all had to pay a flat tax, the people of lower income, lower of lesser means, would have to pay more. This is a way of getting the money we need to run government in inflicting the least amount of pain. Now, what the argument is that I've seen from our editorial board and others is, we can't trust Springfield with our tax money. That's the campaign they're saying. It's like, why are we giving them more tax money? And that's actually just an inversion of the actual question, which is like, how much, you know, that's bringing it back to the whole spending question and what we want the government to do. And if we don't change the way how much money we spend in government, then we're going to keep our flat income tax, then let people of lesser means are going to have to pay more. And it's really interesting to me that Pritzker is spending $5 million of his own money for a law that's going to really nick him badly. I mean, you know, I know grief about his toilets and pulling toilets out, but he's going to pay a lot more in taxes.
It won't affect. It's a paper cut.
If you didn't tell him about it, I don't know that he would even notice.
This is part of the point.
It doesn't impact his life.
It's part of the point, though,
but not
John?
Everybody's a billionaire. If the threshold is $150,000, the word that I always take offense to is fair. They want a fair tax. And I'm not sure that people making $151,000 aren't already paying a quote-unquote fair amount.
I think the threshold is only that you would see your taxes go down at 150 level, $50,000. If you make that $151,000, you will pay the same amount, and then it sort of ramps up. So maybe if you make $250,000, you'll pay $100 more a year.
So you're not paying the higher rate on the
Well, then I understand how graduated income taxes work, but I still
see, here's how it works, Sean.
Yeah, why don't you explain it to me? Yeah. Because I think
Bert
that
Transplaining.
I was going to say, I wish we could show off your matching cable knit secession sweaters that I'm very much enjoying.
Yeah, we posted pictures of Steve and I and our colleague Ryan Burrow wearing our sweaters. We happened to look like a Gap ad yesterday. And producer Elif posted pictures of us saying we were all 25% off this week at Gap. And a lot of people would take it. Okay, I'll just make this one point last time, and you guys can tell me I'm wrong or I'm rich. I don't know that I'm either, but I think that if you make $200,000 a year, and we say, well, we can take even more of your money, those people are already paying a graduated federal income tax. And I'm just saying that I think they're nick for those people, for government. Those people do have trouble buying the houses that they should be able to afford and putting their kids through college and living the lives they feel like they deserve to live.
They have trouble buying the houses they want to buy.
I had my violin with me. I left it at home. But no, I mean, seriously, John, the part of the point is that, yes, in I think something like 38 states, we have graduated income taxes. And the reason is for what I've been saying, is that when you have them that way, then you can inflict less pain on people who are earning less. And so, yeah, Pritzker's not going to notice it at all, probably. So I can say, my gosh, we can't afford our third home in Colorado, whatever. That is the way you can manage to pay for the government that we need without having too much of the burden fall on lower income earners.
Don't you think it's fairer, John, that if you have more money, that you would pay a higher percentage
of
your income?
Yes, I do, and I already am.
But that's what we're talking about.
I know that, but I think, where's the end of that? Where does that end?
So then you can argue about the rates, maybe. But
maybe I can, or maybe I could argue about spending. I think that's what I'm trying to do here. I think that people that make a decent amount of money are paying a ton of taxes. Just to continue to go to them is saying, here's the solution, I think is in fact unfair to those people.
Well, one of the other arguments that gets made is that if you have a progressive income tax system, a graduated tax system, it's going to make it easier on the General Assembly to raise taxes on the middle class. And I've actually looked at that question. I actually looked around the country at states, the many, many states that have graduated tax systems, to see, like, do they raise taxes more on middle class people? And the answer is, of course, they don't, because it's still a political, very big, heavy lift to raise taxes on the middle class. So this is a fall. You can hear this argument a lot.
Well, let me ask you this.
Does make it easier.
Does this solve the problem? All right, so suppose that works and it happens and you tax people with a little more money, a little more, and with a lot of money, a lot more. Does that how much does that help the state of Illinois and all of the other people?
Well,
does it work?
It says $3.7 billion is what the governor says it will raise, and that will help get Illinois on a path to financial stability and pay down the budget backlog, as well as making a significant contribution toward pensions.
That's $5 million well spent. If you can spend $5 million.
Oh,
you said $5 million.
Say
$3.7. On to the Chicago Police Department. They have for some time had a merit system for promotions. What could be wrong with the merit system, right? It's merit. That's the way to go. The idea, if I understand it correctly, has been to enable Chicago Police Department to promote officers who don't test well. That's an idea that would benefit some minority rank-and-file officers, right? But rather than just doing that, it's actually being abused. And so instead of increasing the minority ranks, Eddie Johnson said we're woefully inadequate in that department. They're actually using it as favors or privilege. It's not actually been an effective tool. So the interim police chief says, okay, I'm going to do away with that, and I'm going to suggest that the next superintendent does away with that, too.
So I had forgotten, because 2016 was approximately a decade and a half ago in real time as opposed to linear time, that the Department of Justice mentioned this in their investigation of the Chicago Police Department as being a source of consternation and frustration among rank and file officers who widely believed that the merit promotion system was used to reward clouded officers who were by and large white, ethnic, and not black or Latino, and that the Department of Justice recommended that it be done away with and revamped. So I thought the most important thing that Charlie Beck did was that he said that the department should hold promotion exams every 2 years. The last promotional exam for lieutenants was held in 2014. It's 2019, almost 2020. So that, I think, is the real source of the problem with the current system.
So the criticism is legitimate.
And nobody quite understands what the rules are. It depends on which superintendent is in the chair, right? This superintendent handles promotions one way. This another superintendent handles it another way. And a lot of sort of the people who are higher ups really are having the say here. Yeah, let's let this guy in. Let's let that guy in. And I don't know that race has anything to do with sort of how well people are testing, because as Heather just mentioned, this is about sort of clouding in sort of my buddy's kid, or you know, so and you know, white, ethnic, largely male police officers. And yeah, so this started in the 1990s under Daley. He thought that this was a good way to sort of diversify the department, and in fact it didn't move the needle at all.
Is Lori Lightfoot going to abide by this? Is she on board?
Yes, she has.
And is this another example of no-nonsense, Lori? I mean, she doesn't put up with crap, it seems, and we should cheer on this effort?
Well, I think it speaks for itself that Rahm Emanuel didn't even come close to touching this. So, for example, he focused a lot on the Department of Justice's recommendation for increased training and a new training facility for the police department.
Right.
He did not say anything about the merit promotion system, because it was such a sacred cow for so many people who had supported him and given him money and supported the alderman whom he relied on to get things through the city council. What I thought was interesting was that the Fraternal Order of Police also said, yep, we agree, this system is not right. And I can't remember the last time the Fraternal right. Order of Police and Lori Lightfoot agreed on, you know, literally the color of the sky.
It's true. And that is what is fueling my conspiracy theories about whether Charlie Beck is really a temporary superintendent.
I mean, if he goes for the permanent job, we're just all going to play that clip of him blaming his wife for saying that he can't do it.
I know. They are searching. The search is on. I mean, she's got a bit of a timeline. What, at the latest April? So.
But you're not wrong. It's a big swing for a guy who's supposed to be here only for 3 months.
Right.
This is not his place to pass such a sweeping judgment?
No, I don't think so. I think it's the right move. I was surprised.
That he would take this on.
Right, yes.
But maybe it's the sort of thing where an outsider walks in and goes, wait a minute, you guys are doing what?
Well, then why didn't Gary McCarthy do it? Why didn't Jody Weiss do it? Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Like, everybody has come in and been told, that's the third rail. Don't touch it. What? I don't understand what sort of made that change,
it
really.
It does strike me that this is part of a larger conversation we have in the society about how do you measure merit? And when you have a limited number of spaces, and I'm thinking of college admissions, or the judges, right? When people say, oh, we should have merit selection of judges, we shouldn't allow judges to be elected because electing judges is a terrible system. We can see through what's going on in the police department that perhaps merit selection of judges would be an equally, if not more, terrible decision. And when colleges are trying to admit people, they would like not, if you do something like an SAT test or an ACT test as they your own, or grade point averages, I mean, there are so many different ways of measuring merit. You want them all to be honest, meaningful measures of merit, and not he knows somebody or he rows a boat fast or something like that. But this
How
is
do
a,
you do
this
that
is
then,
a broader.
Right?
I know that this is why it's a broad situation. I mean, because if you totally get rid of it and you rely only on these exams, first of all, these exams have a history of cheating.
I was going to say we just sort of lived through a major cheating scandal involving the current wife and then fiance of Eddie Johnson, who tested among the highest of the lieutenants, along with a series of other wives and girlfriends of high-ranking officers.
Eddie Johnson's
officers.
Wife got a real good score, and
she did.
That's known to be fraudulent?
It's not known to be fraudulent. The inspector general investigated it and determined that he had no evidence to suggest that it was, but it raised a lot of eyebrows that all of these really connected female officers scored the highest on this exam, and there were allegations that they were essentially given the test beforehand by the instructor.
So, I mean, but the question becomes, are there exams? I mean, the police work is not... It doesn't seem to me to be the kind of thing that you can say, well, we'll give you a test, and that will tell you how good a police officer you'll be, or I should say, a commander or someone who's in charge of other police officers. Do these tests really measure that? And that's the problem. It's a problem with college admissions. It's like you get kids who score really well on tests who aren't particularly good members of your academic and
vice versa.
The private
sector,
totally vice versa.
In the private sector, there may be some metrics like your sales or your ratings or whatever, but mostly it's subjective. It's a supervisor or supervisors who they don't give you a test. And if you do well enough on the test, the Tribune gives you a raise. They say you're doing good work. We like what you're doing here.
The Tribune doesn't give you a raise anyway.
Yeah, I was going to say.
Okay,
there may not be a test out there that measures this, but it's hard to believe that only. No offense, only white guys are doing well enough to be raised up in a department that is actually more diverse than it's been.
It's not hard to believe though that these tests would have some sort of a racial bias in their results.
Sure, right.
So that's not hard to believe. So if you say, well, we're just going to go, and this is what happened with colleges, right? They say, well, we're just going to look at ACT scores, and then you find that you're not as diverse as you want because these tests, for a whole variety of reasons, don't have the number of minority groups, certain ethnic minority groups, rising to the top that you want, and you want a diverse student body. You really want a diverse police force.
And then it of course leads to accusations of, well, you only got promoted because you're black, or you only got promoted because you're Latino, which is extremely damaging. And you know, Eddie Johnson has spoken about the fact that he had to win over white officers to some extent when he was picked as superintendent. But I think, to your point about did an outsider need to come in and do that, is a strong argument for the next superintendent to not be CPD. And if the next superintendent that the mayor picks isn't CPD, you're going to have a big pushback among aldermen who want to see a homegrown person.
And I guess the CPD as well,
yes.
the FOP.
And how they turn the knot, because they are going to have to adjust. You can't get rid of these exams.
Right.
I mean, you can't have just a merit system. You have to balance it out.
Well, it shouldn't be so hard. If the system weren't corrupt or people weren't awful, it would just happen.
Could you please address that? Please make people not
awful. When I get to be king, let's talk a little bit about the impeachment week that is. Literally, they continue to have testimony today. The vote looks like it's going to be maybe Monday or Tuesday of next week.
One thing that is standing out for me is that the Republicans have better grasped the fact that this is a political war, particularly in the 31 districts where a Democrat now holds the congressional seat, but that Trump carried the district in 2016. And they are going hard with an expensive campaign, campaign style political campaign ads going after the Democratic incumbent for being pro-impeachment. They are trying to portray this impeachment as a unfair witch hunt, making all kinds of process arguments and the sort of things you're hearing from these high volume Republicans in Washington. And the Democrats are not fighting back the way they need to. They need to realize that this is a political battle and that you cannot pretend to stand above the fray, that they need to fight back as hard as they are being fought against, and they're not doing it.
And should they fight it on the process front or the content front?
They should fight it totally on the content. Well, I think the process front is easy to defend. I think the content front is easy to defend. But you know my position on this. I mean, I think this impeachment is warranted, and I think this president is a dangerous megalomaniac who has abused his power repeatedly for 3 years, and we should get him out as fast as we can. that's me. But I think the Democrats need to make that case through 30-second ads. They can't rely on people watching C-SPAN or CNN and listening to these speeches and these hearings, because they aren't. They're busy people. So they're reading their summaries, and they're probably often reading them in their on the news format that best suits
mirrors their views.
I mean, you take it seriously, and I don't think they are. And I think the ad spending statistics show that.
The polling is consistent. People in these battleground states are against impeachment. Washington Post just had a story about it out. It was last week, showing that it's like 52% are against. And they need to be on the ground in Michigan, Florida,
Wisconsin,
Pennsylvania, Nevada. Yeah, Wisconsin, North Carolina, all of these places. It's a kind of a dangerous situation for the Democrats. I mean, people want to say that, okay, you know, this is the right thing to do. I've talked to a couple congressmen. This is the right thing to do.
Consequences be damned.
Yes, absolutely. That's kind of where they're at. We don't care about the polling. We don't care about what's happening in the battleground states. We took an oath of office. I talked to Krishnamoorthy about that, and we need to do it. And not to shift left or right here, but I was struck by sort of the amount, this urgency, this level of urgency. We have to do this now. We believe that crimes are happening right now. They continue to unfold with, you know, this Rudy Giuliani visit to Ukraine being the big piece of evidence.
Well, of the four professors that testified before the Judiciary Committee, the three were Democrats, but one was, you know, there as a guest of the Republicans, and that was his criticism. He said, I didn't vote for the president, and my views on this president aren't relevant. It's the dispatch.
This impeachment would rival the Johnson impeachment as the shortest in history. This would be the first impeachment in history where there would be considerable debate and, in my view, not compelling evidence of the commission of a crime. Second is the abbreviated period of this investigation, which is problematic and puzzling.
I don't know how long an impeachment is supposed to take, but it doesn't seem to me like they're being rash about this, are they?
I think what Jonathan Turley said was idiotic, because he indicated it was as though the Democrats are waiting to call these witnesses, as though the people who we want to hear testify, we want to hear John Bolton, Mike Pompeo, Mick Mulvaney, we want to hear these people testify. They are dragging their feet. They're refusing to cooperate. What are the Democrats going to find? They've found what they're going to find unless you go through the courts and the court system. And these defendants are going to, or defendants aren't defendants, they'd be plaintiffs, I guess. They're going to drag their feet. The Democrats are in a spot. Either they act on this guy, this president, who is trying to impact the 2020 election. And that is where the urgency comes from, in my view. If this would not be seen as a rushed investigation if the Republicans had cooperated with it. But they've stonewalled him. They've obstructed justice. I don't have a lot of sympathy for Turley's point of view.
No, I think that the Democrats are coming back, though. Schiff, Krishnamoorthy, all the folks who are talking about the urgency. I think that that's a pushback, isn't it? It's a messaging. It's to get the message out there, hey, this needs to happen now because crimes are unfolding as we speak. This is continuing to happen. Yes, the impact on the 2020 election, sure, but that's they're trying to push back. They're trying to counter that message.
I'm consistently surprised at how much more popular Trump's impeachment is and has been than Clinton's impeachment at any point during the impeachment process of President Clinton. And I know that that was a long time ago, but I do not remember the sense among the Republicans of, oh no, what if we're overreaching? Oh no, what if we're doing the wrong thing? And of course, it was proven that they lost ground in the next midterm election. And it seems to me as if the Democrats have learned that lesson perhaps too well, rather than sort of just doing the right thing and just saying, hey, this is what we have to do because it's what the Constitution calls for. And I think Nancy Pelosi has tried to make that point several times, rather than trying to game it out and play it down the road. And then if we do this, then that will happen. Mm-hmm, and then this other thing will happen. You know, it's I want the process to be understandable for people. I want people to know why they're doing this and why they're doing that.
Only two articles, only two counts.
Right. And you know, I don't know that we gain anything from as a society as all this you know, focus on who's up in the polls and who's down in the polls and who's winning and who's losing. If he broke the law, then he should be held accountable. That's just the mom in me speaking. Like, if you did something wrong, you got to, you know, pay the price. So let's just let it play out. Nobody really knows how this is going to play out in the Senate. Nobody knows what the impact down the road will be. But there was a significant number of Democrats who felt like the party itself was going to sort of, you know, face a schism if they didn't hold the president to account. So they're sort of getting it both ways.
Yeah, I think that's the problem Eric kept talking about, or walking the Democrats into, unelected Eric Zorn. He was all for the impeachment because that's the right thing to do. But the political price may be about to be paid, and it may be severe.
Well, it's possible that it will. I'll say, though, that I think that my suggestion about them advertising,
right,
like having
so what's the
Donald
ad sound
Trump
like?
A chicken suit.
Give me the ad. Give me this ad.
It's a listen. What are they? Here's, you know, one ad is, you know, what are they hiding? You know, Mike Pompeo won't testify. John Bolton won't testify. What are they? All the people who were supposed to exonerate Trump refuse to testify. These documents that are supposed to exonerate Trump, he won't let us see them. What is he hiding? That kind of thing. Those sort of short messages. Like, this is, you to mitigate the potential political damage. I mean, what the Republicans had back in 1998, he lied about getting oral sex in the White House from an intern. Like, and people were like, yeah, I might have lied about that too. And he was under oath. Well, he went under oath. Betty Curry, all these people around Clinton went under oath. Why don't the people around Clinton go?
And by the way, Bill Clinton was impeached and not convicted because he lied under oath about not having sex with that woman.
Right.
Is that
to a grand jury?
That's it, right? I mean,
yes.
It was all awful what he was doing. It was predatory, but the impeachment wasn't for the act, it was for the lie, right?
Because he went under oath.
In President Trump's case, there's that phone call. I guess it's not that similar, but I'm just kind of intrigued that the two counts against him, the counts or charges? Counts
Articles.
Against him. Articles. The second one is that they weren't sufficiently cooperative about the impeachment process. That's a power the Constitution gives to the Congress. The president is impeding that, and therefore they're going to impeach him for not being sufficiently cooperative with their impeaching of him.
As Nixon was, and that was a straight up article of impeachment against Nixon because he told people to lie and he attempted to conceal evidence.
And if we block Congress's authority to have oversight over the president, then we've just given up. We've said, okay, the president can do whatever the hell he wants as long as he's got at least, what was he, 37 senators, 38 senators. That's all he needs in his party. He can do whatever he wants, and we can't stop him. And we'll just say, well, the voters voted for him, and they'll shrug. And we don't want that. I mean, I think that we've yielded to an imperial presidency.
I wonder if this impeachment process is going to stop that. If, as you said, Lisa, they're worried that these things are still happening. I'm not exactly sure what those things are that are still happening, but maybe there's international interference, or maybe members of the administration are colluding with people they should not be. But I don't know that the impeachment, shy of a conviction in the Senate, is going to stop that anyway. They're going to say we got away with it. I mean, they're not going to impeach him again.
And this is where I think President Trump's lack of ability to feel shame really helps him, right? Because
it's his superpower.
Because at least I always got the sense that President Clinton was at least embarrassed by the whole thing. You know, we're in this bizarre world where at some point I don't have any trouble imagining Trump at a rally saying, and of course I got impeached. That is a badge of honor that I got impeached.
They will roar their cheers
and
at that.
And that, I think, is an argument that he can take to the voters. And I think that he can make that argument, and it is up to the people who go to the polls in 2020 as to whether that holds any water.
He seems frantically
He's tweeting like a madman.
He knows that this is a real stain on him, and if he thought this was so great, he would be lying back saying, "Bring it on," and he is not.
I think that's a fine point.
And I do think I think that a lot of this, because we live in such an accelerated media environment, that by the time people actually go to vote in, you know, was it 11 months from now, a little bit less than 11 months from now, that this impeachment story will be in the distant mirror, and we'll be looking at what the economy is doing. We'll be looking at other issues like healthcare, immigration, those kind of things. I don't think this is going to play a huge role in that vote.
He has a funny brain, because I said within 24 hours, and Steve corrected me on the radio and said it might have been within 24 minutes. He tweeted about the impeachment. and the peril that that creates for him. He tweeted about the markets in China, your trade in China, and the markets reacted positively today at up 250 points. CNN's about to show it to me here. I think we're up a couple hundred plus right now. At the same time, he tweeted about Greta Thunberg and was trolling that 16-year-old climate activist.
Did you see she changed her Twitter bio to reflect the president's tweet? I hope to channel her chillidness, because that's a real flex.
If any one of those things was on my plate, I would be so focused or discombobulated. I couldn't juggle all of those things at the same time. The world's economy, my personal future, and that of the government of the United States. Troll a 16-year-old kid.
Trolling a 16-year-old. We could go back to last week's conversation.
I was going to say, we were just talking about that.
Do not troll a teenager. As president of the United States or anybody else, there's a lot of feeling that he thought he was going to be sort of the person of the year, and then he's ticked off about it.
I think that's a subtext.
He made those fake Time magazine covers.
Yes.
Like somehow Time is really in his brain. What I couldn't believe was during the Clinton impeachment, Lindsey Graham on the floor said, "Well, what if a high crime or misdemeanor isn't actually just a crime, but it's when a person with high power attacks a person with low power." And I thought, wow, we've come a full 180 degrees from Lindsey Graham.
Lindsey Graham's filled with those kind of things. Well, has Trump, I should know this, Trump has not been Time's Person of the Year.
He was in 2016.
Okay, so he's gotten it once.
He is the person of the year this year as well.
He's the person of the year every year because he dominates the news. Just like the Ayatollah was the person of the year, Stalin was the person of the year. I mean, it is not supposed to be an honor.
Well,
I mean,
then how is he not Time's person of the year?
I think they're trolling him.
Make that argument, because last year it was the whistleblowers who launched the Me Too movement, and the year before that it was, you know, other parts of the resistance against the Republican Party. So it's been pretty consistent since 2016 for Time.
It probably doesn't sell a lot of magazines to make Trump that. I think Greta Thunberg is a more interesting story for Time magazine.
I mean, it's a bogus pitch to sell magazines, and we're all talking about it, so they have won. And who among us subscribes to Time magazine? Not me, anyway. It's the person who has the biggest impact on the news, and Trump undeniably has had the biggest impact on the news on the national, international scale for the last 3 years. There's no question about it. But it would be boring if it were every year, right? And be like another thing on Trump, and Trump, of course, would take it as an honor, like the Sportswoman of the Year, that's a good story. Did you pick up on that?
Megan Rapinoe.
Right. Now,
that's
right.
An honor. They don't give that to, like, Michael Vick or something because he made the most news.
And do you... Okay, I appreciate your time today. I've taken a lot of it today, guys. I asked you guys in the message before we got into the studio, what's your favorite Christmas movie or song?
So I will encourage everybody to go watch While You Were Sleeping, a stellar Sandra Bullock Chicago set Christmas movie.
LaGrange.
That sets the right tone for Christmas between sadness and happiness and pathos. And also you will get to see the old Sun-Times newspaper building, which is close to my heart.
Do you happen to know what service it might be on? Is it on Netflix?
I don't believe it's on Netflix. I don't believe it's streaming anywhere. I have several copies of the DVD that I would be happy to lend out.
You don't have
to
have several DVD players, do you?
Who's the youngin' here?
Mr. Zorn, what are you recommending?
I am recommending my favorite song from this year's Songs of Good Cheer concerts, which is Joe Newberry's song On This Christmas Day.
You know, I love Elf. I'm sorry. I know that we're oversaturated with that show, but I love it. I'll watch it when it's on TV, even if it's three quarters of the way done. I just think there's some nice lessons in there. It's mean. It's a Grinch story at one point, and there's redemption, and I just love it. I also like that when he eats the gum off of the railing in New York City.
And Zooey Deschanel is fabulous.
Yes,
I love
me
some Zooey. She's good in that.
She's
What's
so
yours,
good.
John?
The one I'm looking forward to watching right now, we will get through all of them at my house, but the one that's on my mental playlist is Jim Carrey's Grinch. I love the Grinch cartoon, but I really love Jim Carrey as the Grinch Who Stole Christmas. It's the Grinch story. I mean, it's Christmas.
Does everybody at the table like A Christmas Story? That's kind of the classic.
Yeah.
And it was made into a musical, which I thought was delightful. Really, really a good score. I thought the songs in it were terrific.
Another question I have, is Die Hard a Christmas movie?
I don't like violent movies as Christmas movies.
I've never been
end of conversation.
It is set on Christmas.
I know it is. That doesn't make it a Christmas movie.
All right.
So I saw a joke on Twitter that it's not a Christmas movie. It's actually a Harry Potter movie because the hero is trying to escape Alan Rickman.
Heather, thanks for coming in. Lisa, thanks for coming in. Steve Bertrand came and went, but he's doing radio news at WGN. Eric Zorn, it's nice to see you. Justin and Austin will jump in here another day. We're produced by Elif Garris. I'm John Williams, and we will drop another pod on you next week.
Subscribe to the Mincing Rascals podcast on iTunes or the Google Play Music Store. You can now also follow us on Spotify, or you can keep listening online at WGNradio.com. Plus, catch highlights every Saturday from 11 to 11:30 a.m. on The John Williams Show on WGN Radio.